When I was in college, a professor began the term by assigning a novel set in a dystopian future where everything was grim and hope seemed absent. I diligently read the book, which was a science fiction story by Ursula Le Guin, and I'm sure I wasn't the only person thinking that the term was already heading in the direction of being a really serious downer. But the professor surprised me. When we arrived back at class the next week, he split us into small conversation groups, asking that we reflect on our ideal society. Get as far away as possible from the world the book imagines, he urged. In the utopia of our personal dreams, what would life be like? We had some interesting conversation. One of the cool ideas I remember being tossed out was free public transportation, locally and also globally. Can you imagine that? One fellow student in my group had recently interned with a collective that built housing using environmentally sustainable materials like cob, which is a mixture of clay, sand, straw, water, and earth that's similar to adobe. So he shared a long, convoluted plan about everyone getting to create their own one-room living space and that they would adjoin these huge communal compounds he described as being like beehives. I was 19 and thought it was, like, really sophisticated. But I have been forever haunted by the comment of a smart, thoughtful young woman. She was very quiet and listened to all the ideas presented. Then she said, "In my version of a perfect and ideal culture, anyone who abused or mistreated anyone, especially children, would be severely punished." And that's the only conversational contribution she made during that assignment. I hope I will always be first in line to advocate for accountability when wrong has been committed, especially against another person, let alone a child. But in my dreamland of total bliss and complete equality, people would not be harming each other. Couldn't we at least fantasize about what it might mean to inhabit a place where children are not violated? Where we don't have to fear for the safety of our littlest ones. This experience of being confronted with an intelligent and worldly person who had so little capacity to dream big and think outside the box when the opportunity presented itself helped teach me that imagination is complicated. Earlier this month, I met with the facilitators of our journey groups, which is what we call our small group ministry program. They are ending this month, but consider this your way in advance invitation to sign up for one when we start again in the fall, because they are really powerful opportunities for deep reflection in community about our monthly worship and learning themes. When I was talking to the journey group facilitators, I realized how easy it was for me to think of imagination, this month's theme, more like a hobby than a lifeline to a better world for all. These are some instances of using imagination in my life that immediately sprang to mind. When I'm not too tired, I sometimes think of fun cooking projects to do with my niece before I drift off to sleep. When I can scrape together a little extra cash, I call my ever-adventurous best friend and say, "Okay, let's plan a trip." I'm about to take some study leave this summer, and with the gift of a less restrictive schedule, I'm contemplating how I can fit more time for daily spiritual practice into my life. In these examples, imagination is a treat in which to indulge when I have time or other resources. I think I was falling into the trap of believing that imagination is only the purview of the privileged, of those who have luxuries like time and money in the first place. Imagination has its edge of delightful fancy, of course. Remember our first reading? We do not exist. But if you think we do and would like to visit, please knock. But it's a more meaningful act than daydreaming, no matter how wonderful it is to daydream. My own fanciful musings about fun and travel and relaxation are all instances of creative thinking, but they do not fully demonstrate that scope of imagination is essential and fundamental to being human. Reflecting in the journey group helped me see that I hadn't pushed myself to claim imagination as a spiritual and ethical value. Encouraging ourselves to imagine is a practical activity. It's like building a boat, a process about which we learned in our second reading. Boats are solid, they're tangible, and they provide transportation. Imagination, too, is a solid force, strong enough to serve as the structure of many enterprises with much movement and many traveling parts. And before we leave the metaphorical comparison behind us, let me just say that, like a boat, an imagination can transport or move you. It can even save you. In Unitarian Universalism, one of the ways we have access to imagination is through humanism. The worldview of humanism can help us imagine. This might seem incongruent, but it's not. Humanism often gets a bad rep because it can be mistaken for an overly rational perspective, one that's too literal and rigid for expansive beauty and joy. That is one kind of humanism. But I would characterize the sort of flavorless, crotchety kind as more secular because it's not interested in spiritual questions of meaning. And it's also a fundamentalist sort of humanism. By calling it fundamentalist, I just mean that it's an absolutely certain viewpoint, unable to allow for the mystery of the world, or the possibility that another truth might be valid in another context for another person. There's no imagination in that. Religious humanism is not confining in the stereotypical way. Rather, it's one of the least limiting forms of religious expression available to us. The reason it's one of the most imaginative religious forces is because it says yes to so much. It asks us to accept that our physical and spiritual lives are the result of vast and diverse influences, including science, history, human thought, and natural beauty. It even holds a place for those mysteries that have not yet become known to us. All these perspectives, philosophical, biological, environmental, are resources. They're tools we can use to fashion lives of worth and dignity for ourselves. For the religious humanists, and in the past 100 years, religious humanists have also tended to be Unitarians. Imagination is the key that provides hope to alleviate suffering. Rather than being about privilege, it's the opposite. When times are hard, even oppressive, that's when it's most important. This was a new idea to me, that suffering could be addressed by imagination. The Reverend Lewis McGee called this creative imagination, a phrase I borrowed for our service's title today. Although he was born into an AME, that's African Methodist Episcopal family, in Pennsylvania in 1893, by 1927, Lewis McGee was in the Midwest, and he was connected with the burgeoning humanist movement and its many illustrious Unitarians. These include signers of the first humanist manifesto in 1933, which outlined humanist principles in a splashy 15-point platform. So here are some highlights in brief. And by splashy, I mean very wordy, so I'm just giving you a little bit. Religion consists of those actions, purposes, and experiences which are humanly significant. The distinction between the sacred and the secular can no longer be maintained. Believing that religion must work increasingly for joy in living, religious humanists aim to foster the creative in man. We might broaden that man language, but I think the fact that all the signers were straight white American men somewhat limited their perspective. The goal of humanism, it continues, is a free and universal society in which people voluntarily and intelligently cooperate for the common good. And this is my favorite part. Humanists demand a shared life in a shared world. Well, Lewis McGee loved this. He wanted more. But when he eagerly approached a Unitarian minister of his acquaintance about entering the ministry, he was told candidly that he would have to supply his own church, since it was, of course, out of the question for a black man to serve a white congregation, and there were only white Unitarian congregations in existence. Well, he bided his time, not giving up on Unitarianism, but not able to move